Did you fancy doing a measuring worth? What's 2,000 pounds in 1194?
I thought no. I didn't think that was right.
Okay.
Because I think true value in feudal times is land.
So you're denying us a measuring worth again. Okay.
I don't think I'm ever going to do one ever again.
So the only thing restraining me right now is the fact that I don't want our listeners to have to choose between us and end up as surprise witnesses at my trial.
Welcome to Save Me From My Shelf, a literature podcast where we take classic tomes off their pedestal to make you less anxious about reading them. Our jokes come from a place of love and for a specific teaching purpose. However, if you think that making fun of great literature, and maybe some mild swearing, is offensive, this might not be the podcast for you.
Hello, you are listening to Save Me From My Shelf. I'm going to give you a slightly themed introduction today. Sherwood Forest over here is Daniel.
Okay, so... a forest in America where an outlaw lived.
Rancho Notorious over here.
Yeah. It's about the hideout, though, isn't it?
That is a hideout.
Is it? I don't even know what that is. Oh, isn't that a film by Fritz Lang?
Fritz Lang, yeah.
Is that good? I'm going to say Dodge City. Is Abby?
I like that. Okay, and this is a reminder that here at Aston University, we have an undergrad program in English literature. We also have a master's in English. So if you ever want to come study with Daniel and I, please do sign up. So Daniel, what is our text today?
It's been more than a century since the hostile takeover of our native land, but our necks have not grown used to the yoke. Our new rulers may believe themselves more sophisticated and civilized than us, with their dainty manners and highfalutin modes of speech. But we stick to the honest old ways of our forefathers. And if there weren't any honest old ways to begin with, we've just started inventing them, haven't we? National dress, new names, new words, new cuisine, even new architectural styles. And we treat them all as if they were like bona fide family heirlooms. We will never give up fighting. They will never take our freedom. But who am I? A Scotsman from the days of Walter Scott? Or a Saxon from his novel and today's text, 1819's Ivanhoe?
So last time when I did the clue to this episode, I didn't realize that in the 1950s film version, Joan Fontaine plays the mousy love interest, just like she did in the 1940s version of Rebecca. In terms of the content, today we're going to be talking about anti-Semitism, rape, abduction, fires, lots of general death and wounding stuff, heart attacks and strokes, maybe? Daddy issues, and just a ton of stuff about miscegenation.
And it's dull.
And it's dull. Let's not forget that.
Yeah.
Now, many of you may remember from our Canterbury Tales episode that my best friend Justine is a medieval scholar. And for those episodes, we actually installed an emergency red phone hotline here at the Save Me From My Shelf desk, so Justine could phone us in real time as we were recording and give us corrections. The phone is actually still here, gathering dust. And since this is a book set in the Middle Ages, we did actually ask Justine if she fancied helping us out. But she said she didn't want to touch Ivanhoe with a 10-foot pole, and I can't really blame her. Also, she's really busy. That said, we will occasionally make appeals to Justine to call into our hotline in case she has any burning corrections that she needs to get off her chest. Justine, do you have any thoughts at the moment?
I think I know what it is. It's because she didn't want to, because this is on our turf, isn't it? She didn't want to have to, like, play us on our turf. 19th century stuff.
Would you like to do some background for me, please?
Walter Scott was a Scottish historian, sort of legal guy, you know, jurist and judge and things. And he was also the inventor of the historical novel TM, wasn't he?
Yeah, so the historical novel as its own genre makes this really conscious effort to immerse readers into a different time period, And this is so common to us today that it's kind of difficult for us to imagine this ever being a new thing or there being a time where people didn't do this. But if you actually think back to texts that we've even seen on this show, like Moll Flanders or Robinson Crusoe or Macbeth, any historical Shakespeare, right? Any of his histories, these are actually set long before they were written, but we can see that they don't do any world building, right? These authors just keep talking as though it were the normal day. So like, you know, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar's still talking like an Elizabethan. Oh. So Scott really created the historical novel as this kind of new genre, this new escapist fantasy thing, which is his biggest contribution to literature.
So he was born in 1771 to this sort of upper middle class gentry kind of Edinburgh family. The 18th century for Scotland, it was a bit of a mixed bag. A bit of a mixed sporran, maybe, you would say. So at the beginning of the 18th century, it was bankrupted by this abortive colonial scheme. And although Scotland had been in a personal union with England since 1603, because it was bankrupted, it had to be like bought out by England. And the deal was that in return for England paying off Scotland's debts, it would become like unified politically with England, which happened in 1707.
So it's not just we happen to have the same king, but we're still totally divorced countries. Yeah. Now it's we're two different nations in the same country.
Yeah. And we don't have a parliament anymore and stuff like that. Like, that's all gone down south. It was a major centre of like a lot of political rebellions, and it kind of had a sort of crossover with Scottish nationalism, didn't it? This culminated in 1745 with this famous rebellion that got very far south all the way to Derby, but then they ended up turning back and got, you know, beaten at Culloden, and there was all this ethnic cleansing and stuff, which is not very nice. That said, there are all these, like, you know, hostile takeovers, civil wars and stuff. Also, Scotland was a major centre of Enlightenment thought. Adam Smith, David Hume, Adam Ferguson, all that lot.
Craig Ferguson.
Craig, yeah, that guy, yeah, from the chat shows or something. But I think a key thing there is that they were big theorists of history, weren't they? Mm-hmm. And the ways that societies develop historically. So I feel like Scott is drawing from that to an extent, as well as the actual tumultuous events of Scottish history. Equally, they were those universities were major centres of learning, you know, modern disciplines like medicine, which they didn't do at Oxbridge. That was just for fat vicars. But medicine's big in the book as well, isn't it, in Ivanhoe. So I kind of thought maybe there's something going on there. The rise of Romanticism at the end of the century was tied to Scottish national feeling again and, you know, this idea of Scottish identity. So you got, like, Rabbi Burns. He's a big sort of proto-romantic figure. He was, like, a kind of worldwide celebrity. This is where all that sort of tartan and shortbread and, like, tourist trap Scottish identity stuff comes from as a kind of... It's a cultural resurgence of Scottish identity, almost to make up for the loss of a political identity. And Walter Scott kind of comes at the tail end of this moment, doesn't he? So I feel like... You know, it's that, he's almost like a synthesis of that sort of Enlightenment approach to thinking about history models and progress and stuff, but also about national identity and national feeling. And I feel like you get that a lot in Ivanhoe and in his sort of other novels. So Scott was very prolific. He was very popular in his lifetime, you know, alongside this whole Scotland craze.
Very popular.
Very improbably popular. So he wrote Ivanhoe. He also wrote Waverley, as I said, which is a kind of Jacobite novel. That was in 1814. Old Mortality, 1816, Rob Roy, 1817. Loads of other books, a lot of which deal with Scottish history. Edinburgh's train station is called Waverley.
It is indeed.
There are Scott monuments all over the shop, aren't there, in Scotland. I can't think of a novelist who has had a more famous reputation on that sort of national level, like that you would actually have like train stations and stuff named after their books. But also I can't think of somebody that's had such a big drop in fame.
It's really weird because nobody reads Walter Scott today unless you're like doing a master's degree in 19th century lit or whatever. Yeah. But his influence is so enormous.
You can see it, yeah.
So he's like, he almost exists now purely on university curricula. Yeah.
It's like a museum piece, isn't he? Ivanhoe and the American Civil War. The Mark Twain thesis that the Confederates or the Southern dandies and types were so excited by this thought of chivalry and feudalism that they kind of over-identified with the Middle Age world of Ivanhoe and sort of fought the Civil War thinking that they were like knights and shit, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, if you guys read or watch Gone with the Wind, it opens on that quotation about these are the last days of knights and their ladies fair. Ivanhoe really clearly influenced Gone with the Wind, even down, I think, to some of the relationship dynamics and character types in this.
This brings us to another element, the big 19th century medieval revival. We talked a bit about this with Horace Walpole, didn't we? That idea of, in the 18th century, everyone was obsessed with Greek and Roman classical stuff, and only Horace Walpole was interested in Gothic architecture. And he was like a sort of forebear of a big 19th century craze for a romantic or imagined idea of the medieval period. So Victorians are, they constructed a certain model of the medieval period with lots of the sort of cliched views of this kind of high 12th, 13th century chivalric ideal that they kind of rewrote to fit in with their own cultural tastes and morals. And that's kind of really influenced subsequent interpretations of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, we've read Chaucer. There's a lot more, buttholes and farting in people's faces.
I was thinking about, when I was reading this, I was thinking, Middle Ages is just so boring. But then I thought, no, I really enjoyed Chaucer.
Yeah, I really.
And he's the real deal.
Yeah.
Sort of, kind of on the arse end, right? Literally. The point is that the Victorians and then Hollywood, when they made a lot of film adaptations of these novels, are really responsible for a certain image of the Middle Ages that we're still kind of stuck in.
Just as a bit of a note, because Walter Scott is responsible for a lot of our current and very wrong views of this period, Daniel and I actually did a bit of a field trip. We went to a Ren fair this week because I wanted to see just how much aesthetic blood Walter Scott has on his hands, and it turns out quite a lot.
I like that term, aesthetic blood, on someone's hands.
All right, shall we see what this big old turkey's all about?
Yeah.
Big old turkey leg at the Ren fair.
And so it begins, 1194 AD, Anno Domini, England.
Check you out, Mr. Mensa.
Yeah. King Richard the Lionheart has been fighting a crusade in Palestine, and on his way back to England, has been captured by the Duke of Austria and is being held for ransom. Oh no, that's terrible. This means that England is stuck under the rule of the oppressive Prince John, Richard's shitty little brother. Even worse, all the lords, feeling that Richard's not there, they're getting a bit more tyrannous, aren't they? They're kind of punching down on their peons, generally making living conditions pretty horrible. This is exacerbated on ethno-national lines, isn't it? So we're not long after the Battle of Hastings, so all the nobles and, royal family and everything are Norman French.
Yeah, the Norman French, they're real pinkies up kind of people.
Exactly, yeah. Meanwhile, you've got all the disgusting serfs, peasants and stuff, and a couple of aristocrats, I should add. They're all Anglo-Saxon.
So the Norman invaders have set out to cancel all men with Germanic roots. It's Hansel culture.
Yeah, that's almost quite good. So Scott begins with this commentary on how pure English isn't a thing, that the English identity is a composite, and that a series of invasions have made up our national character and culture today.
So this is a whimsical tale of cultural incongruity about the clashes between the French people who went to England and the people already there who hate them. It's Abby and Daniel the book.
Good, very good.
So now let's zoom in on the Midlands, or the southern north of England.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a mixed identity. Yeah. Nobody's pure.
Sherwood Forest, to be exact. And we're introduced to two Anglo-Saxon serfs walking through the forest dressed in their old Anglo-Saxon rags. And boy, oh boy, do we ever get descriptions about their clothes. I mean, truly, paragraphs and paragraphs. Mm. And then, just when you thought it was over, Scott mule kicks you in the chest and screams, "Think again, dummy!" So one of these men is named Girth. He's a swineherd.
Not with an I.
No. Girth with a U. That's a different... It's a porn parody that writes itself, really.
Ooh, yeah.
The other man is named Wamba, and he's some sort of court jester. His father was named Witless, so I guess Wamba is like some sort of Nepo baby or something.
Yeah. But everybody's a Nepo baby under feudalism, aren't they? My dad was a swineherd, and I'm a swineherd.
Thought about it in those terms. Wamba is a really insufferable character, and I would go so far as to say that Wamba is the Jar Jar Binks of the book.
Yeah.
These guys both have iron collars around their necks because they are owned by this fancy lord, Cedric.
Walter Scott invented that name for this book.
Cedric?
Yeah. Apparently Sir Dick was an Anglo-Saxon name, but he changed to Cedric. Wendy?
Oh, I was going to say
Darren.
Darren, what's that from? Bewitched?
He's the first Darren.
He is.
No, he is. He's the
really?
First. That's why they keep getting his name wrong. We call him Durwood.
Really?
Sherwood Forest.
Oh my god, we've cracked this thing wide closed. That's nothing. I'm already getting upset thinking how bad the wigs would be in this movie.
The porn film.
Any version of it.
Cedric's Merkin left a lot to be desired. Merkin could be a character in it. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Back on track. Wamba and Girth talk about the language shift that's happened since the Normans have taken over. So they're like, oh, you know, if something involves peasant work, an object is then called by its Germanic name. But when it's time for the Normans to consume that thing, then it becomes French. That's why the animal is a swine, but the food is pork. A sheep becomes mutton, calf becomes veal, etc., etc. And I really like this bit.
This is the best bit.
I'm sorry to say that this is as cool as the book gets.
Also, this is like such basic trivia now. Is it even true? Like, I don't even know. Justine?
Don't call to Justine. She can't help you.
So, a storm approaches. Girth and Wamba are overtaken on a road by some Normans. The two main guys are a Benedictine monk and an exotic-looking Templar, a knight, who's just back from crusade. Just back from crusading.
Going on a crusade. Anyone need anything?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. We get a many-page rundown of, you know, all the clothing that all of these people are wearing, and some clothing they might even be thinking about. We
it really is like that. Every f***ing piece of clothing under the sun.
The monk imagined a t-shirt. But they didn't have t-shirts then. There are a few lines like that, aren't there, as well. This is where that came from, that historical novel.
This new thing, the potato.
Yeah, you know, exactly. There's a line later on, it says, of course they didn't have forks then. They ate with their hands. F*** off. So the travellers see Wamba and Girth, and the Normans are like, oh, excuse me, do you know of anywhere that we, some Norman, can shelter for the night to wait out the storm?
You found a poncier accent than Dorian Gray and Max de Winter put together. That's amazing.
The two peons suggest their master, Cedric's estate, nearby. But it turns out their master is a Saxon. So this might lead to some hilarious culture clashes. It's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, isn't it? So he's one of the few very wealthy Saxons that managed to maintain his land under the Normans. And what's more, check this out, lads, he's guardian of the fair Lady Rowena. She's some kind of disenfranchised Saxon princess. She's like the last in the line of the old kings. Athelstan and Ethelred and all of those guys, you know, the loser kings. The travellers, they're like, ooh, I've heard of Rowena's fabled beauty, and they have a bet. The monk is like, Rowena's English rose good looks are hotter than all the exotic dark-haired wenches in the Holy Land. And the Templar's like, yeah, I'm ready to take that bet.
He's like, I don't know, monk, I've seen a lot of hot chicks in my time, if you remember, because I'm Norman from France, the place where ladies wear no pants. Cedric the Saxon's big hall is straight out of the medieval cliché catalog, and you better believe we get paragraphs of description about the thatching and the exact quality of the rough boards making up the long tables, and the roaring fire, and the stonework, and the dirt floor, and you better believe that we hear the different conditions of every f***ing chair in the room. I do genuinely wonder what part of the brain Sir Walter Scott thought this was supposed to light up.
That's such a great way of putting it.
Just what pleasure centers do you think you're tapping into right now? We finally meet Cedric, and he's a Frank talk.
What? I thought he was English. You said he was a Frank.
That's cute. A Frank talking.
Ah, thank you.
That was funny and annoying.
Okay.
We finally meet Cedric, a frank-talking, slightly short-tempered, but ultimately kindly guy. And he thinks this Norman invasion thing simply should not be allowed. Someone should put their foot down! So after pages of hearing what he's wearing, and then pages of what all his servants are wearing, the plot finally turns up.
You know, when people have sexy phone calls and they say, what are you wearing? Maybe that's the pleasure center. Well, a leather baldric, and
the Norman travelers arrive, and this is where we learn that Templar knight's name, Brian Bois Guilbert. Brian. I guess he's from the Irish part of Normandy.
So the names in this are so strange. Cedric doesn't sound right, and the fact that it's made up confuses me even further. But Brian, yeah, it's a Celtic name.
He's the sixth Derry girl.
Yeah.
Bois Guilbert's arrival strikes fear even into Cedric's brave heart, because Cedric is familiar with Brian Bois Guilbert's LinkedIn profile. Bois Guilbert is a brave and mighty warrior, but cruel and dissolute beyond measure.
Good.
Few men have come back from the Holy Land alive. There is a reason he is one of them. And I would like to pause here in celebration of Brian Bois Guilbert, who is about to serve us villain classic. He has two defining traits, horny and mean.
Ooh.
There is zero attempt at psychological complexity. I love him. 10 out of 10. No notes. So then we get lengthy descriptions of what clothes all these travelers have changed into for dinner. And I love a good costume change, but Scott is taking the piss. This should be called Taking the Piss the Book. So I'm going to skip over a lot of ceremony and bullshit here and jump straight to when Rowena finally comes in for dinner. And Brian Bois Guilbert instantly goes, "Wow, monk, you win the bet. She's the hottest chick I've ever seen." So Rowena is tall, blonde, has blue eyes, ringlets in her hair, and is all around angelically beautiful. Very My Angel is a Centerfold. And of course, we get long descriptions of what she's wearing, which I do want to point out is a crimson and sea green gown, which is hideous. This needs to be a much gayer book. RuPaul would eat her alive, and she'd deserve it.
So, they're having their tea, whatever. Someone comes knocking on the door. They want shelter. Guess who it is? Isaac of York, a Jew. That's fine, isn't it? There's nothing wrong with that. No, there is something wrong with that. And Brian de Bois Guilbert points that out. How can you let a Jew in the house when we've actually got a protector of the faith here?
Are you trying to insult me?
Well, yeah. They have this very tense dinner in the hall. A bit of stuff about pork and stuff, some jokes there.
It's called a callback, Daniel. Pork.
Oh, yeah. But this time about Jews. I'm calling it pig. He's calling it pork. I can't even eat it. Yeah. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, good. The comedy Jew accent.
Okay. Conversation eventually turns toward this crusade. And one of Brian de Bois Guilbert's men talks about Sir Wilfrid of Ivanhoe, another crusader, and how he's really good at knightly feats.
He's the bee's knees.
This turns out to be the wrong choice of topic. Because not only would Bois Guilbert challenge Ivanhoe to a tournament if Ivanhoe ever makes it back to England, but he's also Cedric's estranged son. So he's a Saxon lad, but he's pledged allegiance to Le Roi Richard, whatever, Richard the Lionheart, Coeur de Lion, hey, the king.
Sounds messy. Like yeah. Marie Kondo, I love mess.
Father's heart's broken, he betrayed their race, and what's more, Ivanhoe and Rowena fell in love. But Cedric wants Rowena to marry a better Saxon lord, one that is descended from the royal line of Saxons, so they can get it back going, you know, get the whole band back together. Ivanhoe better step off, is the message there.
So now we cut to a little overview of things in England. Remember, the narrator says, not only do we have all these tensions between Norman rulers and their Saxon peasants, but also between Christians and Jews. So Jews were forced into very few industries, and the chief of them was money lending. And a bunch of Christian lords have borrowed a lot of money over the years from the Jewish money lenders, and now they're faced with having to pay it back. We kind of don't want to do that. And one of these borrowers was even the evil Prince John, who wants to usurp the throne and generally make things horrible for all of his subjects. So, guys, we know this story. We know this story from just about every film adaptation of Robin Hood. Speaking of Robin Hood, a lot of poor subjects are being pushed off their land for their inability to pay taxes, and they're taking to the woods, which is forbidden. Mm. And they're robbing people, which is double forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't sound like things are going well under Norman rule. Maybe they could put out a suggestion box or something.
Mm.
But enough of that. There's this big tournament coming up that's to be enjoyed by lord and peasant alike. Very bread and circuses, you know, to distract the population from its misery with some big spectacle. So, We cut to the day of the tournament, and we get, of course, a very long description of the landscapes and how the tournament is set up and how all the pavilions are constructed. And then we get to see the attendees. Every muckety-muck is here, and we get to hear how they're dressed. And then we go down the whole social ladder to the lowliest peasant and hear how they're dressed. We finally find the plot again when we stumble upon Isaac the Jew in the crowd, and of course hear how he's dressed, and he's with his beautiful daughter, Rebecca, and she's given the whole Orientalist treatment. She's got exotic looks and these dark ringlets, this wonderful Eastern dress complete with a turban covered in ostrich feathers. She's wearing these huge jewels like she's wearing those Marvel Infinity Stones, and she's just generally boobily breasting her way through the crowd.
I've got some things to say about this. Firstly, the tournament is in Ashby de la Zouche, where I once lived. Mm-hmm. Now it has a biscuit factory.
Okay.
Two, the one thing I thought I knew about this book was that Walter Scott made loads of medieval stuff up, and one of the things he made up was that the knights have to be lowered onto their horses from a crane. That doesn't happen. So the one thing I thought I knew about this book is wrong. Where did I get that from?
I don't know if that's actually what happened as well. Like, Justine, did knights actually have to be lowered from a crane onto their horses because their armor was so heavy?
So, we get all the rules about how the tournament works.
Oh, come on, Walter Scott. You know I'm not interested in spectator sports.
First, you get the joust. The winning jouster picks who he thinks is the prettiest lady in the crowd and names her to be Queen of Love and Beauty. She will then pick who the best knight was on the second day of the tournament. It's all politics, isn't it? It's not really about who's the best.
That's what losers tell themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a bit fraught. Brian Bois-Guilbert does well on the first day, but the crowd do not like him. No. Suddenly, a new challenger, one who refuses to remove his helmet or tell us his real name. He goes by the name Desdichado. It is Spanish. It means disinherited, and his shield bears the image of a strong English oak tree pulled up by the roots. Who do you think that's going to be? An oak tree that's been pulled up from the roots, so he's English, but also he's disinherited, blah, blah, blah. He boldly challenges Bois-Guilbert, and the crowd gasps. Don't you know how dangerous a man Bois-Guilbert is? The knight is either brave or foolhardy.
But the crowd is already charmed by this new guy's noble bearing, even if they can't see his face. He's that charismatic. And the prefab I wrote is, he looks like an action figure. He's four Patrick Swayzes in one. He's Genghis Ken.
Very good. They joust, and the mysterious knight knocks Bois-Guilbert from his saddle. Oh, the humiliation. Bois-Guilbert pulls a sword, ready to slice this newcomer in twain, but the officials tell him that he lost fair and square, and he needs to cool it. Ref! Hey, ref! Ref! Anyway, watch your back, disinherited knight, because I am going to be coming for you. So the disinherited knight is like, come at me, bro, I'll be waiting. And the disinherited knight, he just keeps winning everything, doesn't he? He's just so good at jousting. He's really, really, really good. Really good. He's the best knight of the day. He therefore gets to pick the tournament's Queen of Love and Beauty. After a very long section about this, we get all the requisite political background and everything, the knight picks the fair Rowena, a Saxon wench.
Peas and carrots, peas and carrots.
Yeah. Pork. Weirder still, the disinherited knight, he won't remove his helmet, even when Prince John asks him to. The mystery is eating people up. You know, it's like Real Housewives of Hastings or something, ain't it? Meanwhile, Rebecca, the Jewess, a woman who is Jewish, let's say that.
She's Jewish.
Very good. She is impressed with this knight, and she might also be catching the odd feeling for him.
This is the medieval equivalent of watching people play Super Smash Brothers, and yet she's tearing up at it like Cher at the opera in Moonstruck.
This is why this is for teenage boys, isn't it? Because everybody dreams that he's like doing really well in Super Smash Brothers, and the girls that are unfortunately in the room are like, wow.
He's so beautiful.
Yeah, I can't believe he just inhaled that guy, because that's Kirby. You can do that, can't you?
Day two of the tournament, and it is all about sword fighting. So the knights are separated out into teams to just wallop on each other. I don't know the rules. I went into a fugue state. I really don't care. The Disinherited Knight is on one side, and Bois Guilbert is on the other. The Disinherited Knight does well for a while, but he's eventually overwhelmed. Ooh, looks like curtains for him, until suddenly, he's weirdly rescued by some new mysterious knight, who only goes by the name the Black Sluggard. Well, he's not so sluggish now, and he wallops Bois Guilbert's side before mysteriously disappearing into the crowd. Who was that? What was that? Are you allowed to just tag team in like it's pro wrestling? Whatever just happened, this gives the Disinherited Knight the kick in the ass that he needs, and he gets his second wind and properly defeats Bois Guilbert's team. Once again, the Disinherited Knight is declared the victor of the day, and it's time for him to be crowned by Rowena, the Queen of Love and Beauty. But the rule is, you gotta take your helmet off. So as he goes, you know, still helmeted, Cedric is like, wow, this guy really reminds me of the son I never wanted. And the Disinherited Knight goes, I am the son you never wanted, Wilfred of Ivanhoe. So he takes off his helmet, Rowena lets loose a little scream, and Cedric jumps up to his feet. What's he doing here? Get away from Rowena, you cad. I know you guys had a thing going on, but Rowena is going to be married to a higher ranking Saxon. The fate of our people depends on it.
So, Ivanhoe. He looks a little bit pale and shaky, doesn't he? He looks a bit poorly. Just as he gets crowned the day's winner, he swoons. So, when they take off his armor, they see that his side has been pierced in battle. Will he die? Probably not, because we have 3/5 of the book to go. But it's kind of embarrassing to come back from the war and then to be put on death's door by an escalated game of Capture the Flag. So, Isadweeb is the conclusion there.
Well, yeah, his name is Wilfred. Of course he's going to turn out to be a dork. That's classic nominative determinism.
Anyway, we'll move on from the knights to the yeoman, baby. I'm all about the yeoman, and they're doing the archery contest. So Ivanhoe, he's in the hospital tent, isn't he? He's bleeding to death somewhere. He's not competing. But there's a new impotent upstart in a Lincoln green outfit, and he's very, very good at archery. He's devoted to King Richard, and he's extremely mouthy to Prince John, isn't he? Rude.
Who is this twink with all the arrows? It's not Apollo. It's not Saint Sebastian. It's
Robin of Locksley, aka Robin Hood. Robin Hood. Robin Hood. That's what Americans say, isn't it?
So, we know how this goes.
Yeah, exactly. It's in all the Robin Hood movies. This is where it comes from, isn't it? So Robin's the best archer. He shoots a perfect bullseye, and then he shoots another perfect bullseye when there's an arrow already there, and shoots the arrow in two. Hooray for you, Robin.
Prince John has a big dinner that night with all the lords, both Norman and Saxon.
Hey.
And it ends in insults toward the Saxons, as it always does. I don't know why we're surprised by this, especially when everyone started real early that day, if you catch my drift. It also allows some of the Norman dudes to start plotting some further BS together. See, Brian Bois Guilbert has gotten chummy with this other Norman lord named De Bracy, and De Bracy needs money. So, with the help of Bois Guilbert, who's always up for some evil f***ery any time of day, they're gonna kidnap that great Saxon heiress, Rowena, and force her into marriage. What's better, Brian Bois Guilbert is a Templar knight, so he can't get married. He's no competition to De Bracy. Bois Guilbert is just in it for the fun of it. It's always good to have a friend who's in it purely for the chaotic evil, not the lawful evil or the neutral evil.
So, let's get back to Le Noir Fainéant, as he's called, aka, for us Anglo-Saxons, the Black Sluggard, that mysterious knight who helped Ivanhoe in the tournament. He disappeared after his assistance and ran off to Derbyshire. That's what you do when you're on the lam, isn't it?
Where's he going to go? The Critch Tramway Village?
That's a good day out. You know about that? The Tram Museum. Yeah, I love that. All this book is set in like my old stomping ground, so it's quite... doesn't help. It's kind of more boring for that.
Well, now we know when you go on the run where to find you.
He was on the top deck of this tram just going round and round. The narrator just starts calling him the Black Knight.
I'm not not sure why we even bothered with the black sluggard in the first place if he's going to have a name change in his second act. Why even bother? It's never explained. It's stupid and I hate it. Continue.
Okay. He's very tired. He gets lost in the woods and then he stumbles on a dilapidated old Saxon church with a hermit inside. The knight sweet talks him into giving him shelter and food, and they develop a nice little friendship, don't they? It's kind of, you know, it's kind of budding romance. So, who is this Black Knight character? He says he's recently back from the Holy Land. Well, could it be King Richard? Coeur de Lion, back from the Crusades? We don't know, do we?
We don't know. It's too obvious, and that's confusing me.
All we know is that he and the hermit, they love a good sing-song, and we get two sing-songs, which is a skippable offence.
Oh, I skipped right over those.
Yeah, me too. I was like, thank you. But then the songs came up, I was like, phew, something I can just explicitly skip. Then a knock on the hermitage door. So, who could be here, out in the abandoned woods, at this hour?
But we don't find out, because we cut back to Ivanhoe. Remember him, the narrator says? The hero of the story that Walter Scott doesn't actually seem that interested in? So whatever happened to him after he fainted from getting shanked? Oh, hold on, the narrator says. Before we talk about that, let me talk about Saxon superstitions, or Cedric's internal monologue, or maybe some groups preparing to travel and how they pack their suitcases, blah blah blah. You know the phrase, he's lost the plot? You don't need to use it metaphorically with Walter Scott. He is incessantly losing his own plot. He eventually gets back to Ivanhoe, but he tells us all this in a very roundabout way, so I'm gonna cut straight through the bullshit and just get on with what happened. Wounded Ivanhoe, collapsed on the tourney ground, he was carried off the field of battle into a tent, and Rebecca, the Jewess, who had watched him in the crowd and admired his bravery, is like, you know what, I'm basically like a doctor, I'm a really good healer, I'm gonna go help him. So she patches him up, but he needs a lot longer convalescence, you know, and he has nowhere to go. It's not like he can go back to Cedric's place, right? Like, his dad has already converted that bedroom into a home gym. Mm-hmm. So Rebecca and Isaac are like, we'll take Ivanhoe with us. We're going to put him in our carriage. We'll take him up to York with us where he can recuperate. And they use their vast wealth to hire a whole bunch of goons to protect them on the long and dangerous journey back to York. They get pretty much as far as, like, right outside the tourney gates, basically. And the hired goons hear about this band of merry robbers in the area, and they start pissing themselves at the idea. So they pocket Isaac and Rebecca's money and then just abandon them in the woods with a wounded Ivanhoe in the carriage. Bad Yelp review, I'm thinking.
Yeah. We cut back to Cedric, Rowena, and the band of Saxons. They're all leaving the tournament, and they pass by Isaac and Rebecca. They don't see Ivanhoe in a coma in the carriage. The Jewish family begs the passing Saxons to, you know, let them join their party. Safety in numbers and everything. But even Rowena's like, ooh, no. Rebecca whips back her veil to reveal her huge pleas for mercy. And makes an impassioned speech. You Christians would leave a young woman, a feeble old man, and our injured friend hidden in our carriage to be slaughtered by bandits? We share the same God. Well, only a third of the same God. That's what I'm thinking. Anyway, that twinges a few guilt muscles in the Saxons. They're like, okay, come along, phew. About 30 seconds later, the whole party is captured by those famous bandits, and bound and gagged.
Do we get a cool battle scene, Daniel?
Good question. No. We get a few lines.
Well, I'm so glad Walter Scott saved all of his prime real estate for Cedric's big suitcase packing scene. Fuck's sake. Anyway, Girth and Wamba are able...
Those guys, I love them.
Remember
Timon
them?
Timon and Pumbaa.
They are Timon and Pumbaa. Did Jar Jar Binks have a friend? I don't know. I don't watch those movies.
Timothy. Jar Jar Binks' friend.
Timothy.
Timothy and Jar Jar.
So Girth and Wamba, they're able to run away before they're captured, only to run directly into the bandits. But wait a minute, these aren't the same bandits that just captured our master. Why, it's only bleeding Robin Hood! Who'd have thunk that there would be two groups of bandits spawning basically on top of each other in the forest like a video game glitch? Anyway, Girth and Wamba join the merry men and get all excited about their upcoming escapades with, quote, good hope of booty. Is that how boys talk to each other in the locker room?
It's just locker room talk, don't worry.
So to make an unbearably long story short, there's a lot of buffoonery and songs and thigh slapping and grab assing and lots of men putting their hands on their hips and throwing their heads back to laugh, and I hate every second of it. And Tom Bombadil is probably there going, can you please keep the noise down? Because my hot wife Goldberry is trying to commune with nature. So eventually, Wamba and Girth remember that their master and friends have been kidnapped. So they tell Robin, and he and the Merry Men decide that they should form a rescue party for whomsoever kidnapped them. Or, in Isaac's case, whoever old man napped him.
Yeah.
That's one of my dad's jokes. Yeah. Robin and his dudes are like, you know what? I bet it's some Norman assholes up to their usual tricks. And I bet they're probably taking everyone to this nearby Norman castle. I think, says Robin Hood, that we might need some help.
Ooh, plans are brewing. That's exciting. ... Do you all remember the Black Knight, the mysterious man that helped Ivanhoe during the tournament, who then fled, is now shacked up with a hermit, and they're having sausages on sticks? Do you remember that there was also a mysterious knocking at the hermit's door? And it was a cliffhanger, and it was very exciting. And, you know, we've had loads of filler and everything, and so we've completely forgotten everything about it. Do you remember all of that?
No. It's been so long.
Yeah. Well, we're back, anyway. Just, that's all back on. The knock is back. Guess who it was? It was Robin Hood. Robin Hood! Because if he's got to pull off the most audacious rescue today, he needs all hands on deck. Robin Hood's like, well, I'd like to extend an invitation for you two boys to join us.
I mean, it's less of an invitation and more a forced conscription.
Why would he go to a hermit's house?
Daniel, if I knew why anything happened in this book, I'd be a happy woman. I don't know.
So, now let's go back to Cedric, Rowena, Rebecca, and all of the other captives who were imprisoned in the castle.
So guys, there is a whole subplot about some other Norman dude whose castle this is, that they're borrowing for their bulk kidnapping. I don't remember his name. It's like Pierre Fromage or something like that. It doesn't matter. It's a rich Norman dude's castle that De Bracy and Bois Guilbert are like Airbnb-ing.
Anyway, do you remember that bet that Bois Guilbert lost to the monk at the beginning of the novel when he admitted that Rowena was the most beautiful woman Bois Guilbert had ever seen? Do you remember that bet?
Yes, very clearly, yes.
Okay, that's good. Well, Walter Scott doesn't remember. Because all of a sudden, when Bois Guilbert and his buddy De Bracy are conferring about how the kidnapping went, Bois Guilbert is like, I care not for your blue-eyed beauty.
You did 2 days ago!
Well, maybe he's got to know her.
Her personality's piss poor. Yeah. Actually, that is a genuine critique. She's very bland, Rowena.
There we go. So, Rowena's a 10, sure, a dece, but I guess I found an ons, an 11.
But you can't mean the Jewess, says De Bracy. Brian, you're not gonna do a miscegenation, are you? But surely not. You're a Templar. You can't even get married in the first place.
Bois Guilbert is like, married? Oh, no, you silly thing. My God, could you imagine? No, I'm just going to sexually assault her. Hooray! That's not proper miscegenation. That's just jolly japes.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, I've killed 300 Saracens, and this barely even counts as a sin.
I like assault of all kinds. It's kind of my passion.
Yeah, I don't actually see. I don't see race.
I'll hurt anyone.
And the Normans all laugh. Ha 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 ha.
Daniel, en français.
Oi, 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 oi.
So, there's a pretty weird energy in the book right now, but hey, at least someone has any energy at all. This is a very boring book. So, the two women are brought to their individual bedchambers on opposite sides of the castle. While the men are thrown in the dungeon, we then cut to Rowena, who is very unimpressed by the tacky, if expensive, furnishings of her room. Rowena thinks her digs look kind of like if Carmela Soprano decorated Edinburgh Castle. So, I mean, poor Isaac is like chained up in the dungeon worrying he's gonna die, while Rowena is worried she's gonna die of bad taste. In comes De Bracy, and he's dressed to go a-courtin'. And boy, do we get a long description of his outfit and his hair, and he's got those little shoes with the curly toes on them like an asshole, and he's wearing this fruity little cloak and a fruitier little 50 Shades of Grey mask. And this guy isn't queer, but I'm going to give him a queer reading sting purely because he's absolutely got some sort of queer carrier gene. DeBracy opens with one of the worst pickup lines I've ever heard. You might think I've abducted you, but actually I'm your captive. So Rowena pulls a Mariah Carey and basically goes, I don't know you, which is very savage. And his chat-up game continues to be really bad, and Rowena literally accuses him of sounding like some cliched pop song. She says that he sounds like a, quote, strolling minstrel. And he's like, calm down, baby. I'm just doing that courtly love thing that the chicks are so into. You and me, let's smash.
The point of courtly love is you don't smash. That's what I would say.
Well, Rowena swipes left pretty hard on that. She's like, sorry, I'm in love with Wilfred of Ivanhoe. Oh, Ivanhoe? Your boyfriend? Well, he's here. He's a prisoner, too. But how, you wonder? Oh, he was hiding in the carriage of that attractive Jewess. Who knows what they were getting up to in the back seat? So Rowena begs DeBracy to free Ivanhoe, and DeBracy gives her the whole Phantom of the Opera ultimatum. Okay, I'll free your boyfriend on the condition that you marry me. If not, I'll kill him and you'll still be trapped here. Sadly, Daniel, there is no exquisite three-part harmony in this scene.
He is very good, isn't he, Andrew Lloyd Webber? He is very talented.
So this whole thing doesn't go down well, and Rowena bursts into tears. I too like to approach courtship as if the person I like owes me money.
Let's cut to Rebecca, trapped in her own isolated room. Bois Guilbert comes in soon enough, and he puts on his big romantic act, and it's just as corny as his good pal.
Yeah, he puts out the candles, there's probably a bearskin rug, he's like... got some madrigal singers up in here to set the mood. Hey, baby, what do you have to drink? And she's like, hemlock.
Very good. She refuses his advances. He gets a bit aggressive. So, Rebecca's good at making fiery speeches, and she freezes him in his tracks by saying, stand back and hear me ere thou offerest to commit a sin so deadly. My strength thou mayest indeed overpower, for God made women weak, and trusted their defense to man's generosity. But I will proclaim thy villainy, Templar, from one end of Europe to the other. Each chapter of thy order shall learn that, like a heretic, thou hast sinned with a Jewess. He makes a counter-offer. Or I could just trap you here forever, and then who are you going to tell? Rebecca passes on this kind offer and says God will protect her. There's a strange bit here, isn't there, that about the Templars, where he sort of like analogizes the Templars with the Jews. She's like, aren't you a Christian? And he's like, we pretend to be religious, but all we really care about is money and controlling the world secretly. And she's all like, "Who are you? What are you trying to tell me?" He's like, you're not so different, you and I. And she's like, I think we are quite different. You know, it's a weird bit.
So he changes tactics. He just wants someone to talk to, someone to understand him. And he immediately breaks down and starts telling Rebecca about this bad breakup he had. But it's all okay now, because you and I, Rebecca, we're soulmates, don't you know?
It's like, help me, Rhonda. By the beach.
I can share my burdens with you. I'm sorry I threatened you with violence. Phew, do I feel better after this chat. You're so great. This is so us. And he runs into DeBracy in the hall, and he's like, hey buddy, how's your thing going with your chick? My date's going so well. Rebecca's so great. We're so simpatico. And DeBracy's like, I've got a little problem. And Bois Guilbert's like, well, hey, that's common in men your age. Mm-hmm. And he goes, no, not that. No matter what I do, Rowena just cries. I'm rolling nothing but snake eyes over here. So Bois Guilbert gives him a bit of a pep talk. Oh, buddy, it's okay. It's not easy being sleazy. Mm-hmm. They always say a coerced marriage is 90% intuition and 10% luck. So DeBracy kind of sniffs and goes, really? Thanks, dude. I feel really seen when I'm with you. Then DeBracy and Bois Guilbert are disturbed by a noise outside, and somebody runs in and quickly gives them a letter that's been sent up by Girth and Wamba, telling them they better girth their loins. Yeah.
Very good.
Because we're coming to rescue everyone.
The Merry Men, led by the Black Knight, they storm the castle, don't they? You know, they had that kind of... They can wield that kind of power. Or field that kind of power. Anyway, the Normans are occupied with all the fighting. Meanwhile, Wamba and Gurth free Cedric, who manages to run into one of the Normans' serving wenches, who's an old Saxon hag named Ulrika. She was the most beautiful woman in England, wasn't she, until the Normans arrived?
Well, and now she's, you know, 28 years old.
They knew each other back in the old days, you know, back in Saxon school, I don't know. And he's like, oh, what are you doing here? How can you work for these Normans that ruined your life? And Ulrika's like, a paycheck is a paycheck. But Cedric convinces her that maybe, just maybe, she's got a little bit of vengeance backed up in her system. They talk for ages.
Yet these assholes are doing some big catch-up brunch in the middle of a prison break. Priorities, people!
Everyone's running around the castle. So Scooby-Doo is
This is the most Scooby-Doo I think we've ever had on the show.
Yeah. Except everybody's scrappy.
Oh no, you're right!
It's all mad, everything's crazy. It's very hard to follow. Unlike Scooby-Doo, which is excellently plotted. Rebecca and Isaac meet up, you know, zoinks, and together they find the still wounded Ivanhoe. Rebecca tries to patch him up a bit more, enough so that he can escape, and they get a bit flirty. Ivanhoe, he's not so immune to Rebecca's charms, despite her being a despised Jewess. The narrator even says that Rowena would be pretty jealous if she saw how they made eyes at each other. Turns out, De Bracy wasn't just blowing smoke to Rowena in an attempt to get into her kirtle. Rebecca does have the hots for Ivanhoe, because who wouldn't love this big blonde goober who's mostly unconscious?
And they do have much better chemistry than Ivanhoe has with Rowena. Rebecca has everything Rowena doesn't. Style, intellect, a pulse.
Yeah.
See, I didn't really care about all the jousting and stuff, but this is the spectator event I am fully sold on. F*** watch 1194.
So, occasionally during this flirty siege episode, Ivanhoe throws a bit of, oh, I've got to go and find and protect Rowena. He says that in the conversation. His heart's not in it, though, is it?
Yeah, Ivanhoe, you need to make a proper decision between these two broads. It's time to shit or git, as my dad would say.
The battle goes on for ages. It's kind of thrilling. It's also confusing. Ulrika, the Saxon hag who works for the Normans, is like, my old friend Cedric is right. Suck on this, Normans. She sets the castle on fire in revenge for what for previous atrocities the Normans did to her.
She's burning the castle to the ground? Is this Mansell culture? It's like a big fortress house. It's a good joke if you are a dork.
Okay. Wow. I can't believe that bar was just high enough for me. So, the castle starts to burn. De Bracy is fighting with the Black Knight, who quickly beats him. De Bracy says he won't surrender to some nameless churl, so the Black Knight whispers his true name to De Bracy. And De Bracy's like, "You're who?" And the Black Knight is like, so, you know, oh no, oh shit, okay, I'll surrender and lead you through the burning castle to save our hostages.
So meanwhile, in the same scene, 100 pages strong, the castle is burning around Ivanhoe and Rebecca, who prepare to die together. Suddenly, the door bursts open. A rescuer? No, it's Bois Guilbert, bedraggled and horny from battle. And he's like, come, my beauty, you resisted me once, but no more.
Also, can castles burn? Because they're stone.
I always think that, but there must be, I mean, you get it hot enough if you get enough of the, lava. Like the wood stuff.
Yeah, okay, wow. It's actually melting into lava. Crazy.
Justine, thoughts? Yeah. So he flings Rebecca over his shoulder and he carries her downstairs to a waiting horse. Ivanhoe, meanwhile, just yells. Thankfully, his yells are heard by the Black Knight, who comes in to save him. And everyone gets out of the castle okay, except for Ulrika, who decides to go down with the ship, right? And she spiritually salts the ground where it stood. I bet that place is haunted as hell now. Gurth and Wamba are freed from bondage by Cedric for their bravery, and we have some very long chapters doing a whole post-battle debrief, and it slows the pace to a crawl. So I guess Bois Guilbert ran off with the plot thrown over his saddle too, never to be seen again.
I like that Gert and Wamba are like, now we're free, we will continue to work for you under the same conditions.
You said in the last episode, some servants really truly love you.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah, that's Gert and Wamba. Let's cut back to Prince John. He's feasting in his castle. Word comes in that this important Norman castle that we've been talking about, it's been sacked, in part by the mysterious Black Knight, who revealed himself to be King Richard.
I would never have seen that coming.
Well, it's coming. It was here. Yeah. So what do we do? Do we wait for his return to the throne? Do we have him killed before the public finds out he's here? Do we run and hide? Go to France or something? Go to Mummy's castle. She'll protect me. While they're sorting that out, Isaac of York is trying to track down his daughter. He goes to Templestowe, the big Templar castle, to speak to the Grand Master Templar. He turns up, explains. The Grand Master gets angry, as you might expect. Not at Bois Guilbert, who has broken his vows of celibacy, and is generally a dillweed. He's cross with Rebecca, because a Templar could never do the awful things that Isaac is alleging, and he definitely wouldn't be tempted by the sins of the flesh. At least, not without magical help.
Hey, we don't like magic around these parts. I bet her sleeves are full of dead doves.
This Rebecca is clearly using her Jew powers to entrance him.
In contemporary society, this is known as pulling a Markle. Glad to see that England has really changed its stance on pretty brown women since the 1100s.
That's what it's for. That's what historical fiction... It's like science fiction, isn't it? It's really talking about the present. Oh, we'll find her all right to free Bois Guilbert from her captivity. Ooh. Then we'll burn her as a witch.
So, not really how Isaac was hoping that conversation would go.
He pulls that up, son.
Well, Rebecca is eventually found and hauled into a big trial. Bois Guilbert tries to do this whole, no, she's one of the good Jews thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought maybe if Bois Guilbert breaks out into the If You Could See Her Through My Eyes song from Cabaret. I don't know, I thought this book could use a little more Soft Shoe.
Mm.
You don't get that
but
reference.
You skip the songs, though, don't you?
I wouldn't.
Riddle me that.
I wouldn't.
Aha, caught, hoisted by your impetus.
But it's to no avail. So it's very much a kangaroo court. They've already made up their minds, so she's quickly convicted and sentenced to death. So Rebecca gives this rousing defense and has a final card to play. Okay, you guys want a death sentence? Fine, but we're gonna have God decide who dies.
No way.
Yahweh!
Yeah.
I call on my right to have a trial by combat. So she ends this by throwing down her glove at the feet of the Grand Master in a truly baller move.
Can we have a sound effect in there, please?
No.
Oh. I think definitely put a sound effect of a glove falling.
What would that be, Daniel?
It would be funny, whatever it is.
So the Grand Master accepts. Bois Guilbert, my messy train wreck bitch, is like, baby, this is so great. I'm the strongest knight. I'll slaughter the shit out of any challenger the Templars find. And then we'll move to Bordeaux, and we'll get a cute little duplex, and we'll go to farmers markets on the weekends. They'll hurt you over my dead body. Well, funny you should mention that, the Templars say. See, the thing is, Bois Guilbert, we are declaring martial law on your penis. You're going to be the champion for our side, you being a Templar and all. So if you win the fight to the death, Rebecca burns as a witch. If her champion wins, well, you'll be dead. It's a cosmic cock block.
Word of all of this reaches Isaac.
I'd go all straw dogs on their ass if only my sciatica weren't acting up.
Quickly, I must find a champion to fight for my daughter. I met King Richard earlier, and he's the greatest knight ever. Or, as king, he could just put a stop to this, maybe. But instead, I'm going to choose Ivanhoe, who was catatonic for most of the book, and is still too injured to bear the weight of his armour.
This guy deserves to have his daughter killed, I'm sorry, but this is the guy you choose? Okay.
It's hard to say, Kay. But sometimes it has to be said.
Okay.
So, Isaac rushes off to Cedric's. So, you've got a bit of tension going, haven't we? That's cool. Good excitement. Tension's building. Yep. Excitement.
I'm on board. Yeah, this is coming. This is good, yeah.
Let's have some songs.
No, damn it!
And bullshit at Cedric's place.
Son of a bitch.
So we have a very long chapter of nothing. King Richard, he's there, he pays his respects, and Cedric's like, ooh, this is an honour, but you're still my enemy on account of being French. He manages to convince Cedric to forgive his son, Ivanhoe, for pledging allegiance to a Norman king. I'm just so adorable.
It's very hashtag not all Normans.
So Cedric's like, well, I guess Ivanhoe might as well marry Rowena, who we haven't seen in half the book. But anyway, where's Ivanhoe?
So, while this whole Richard the Lionheart Cedric thing has been going on, Ivanhoe gets pulled off to the side, and he's, you know, told about Rebecca's trial by combat situation. So he Irish goodbyes his own engagement party to go save her. Oh no, but if you do that, who's gonna keep the plot from idling in neutral? He shows up at Rebecca's trial by combat in the 11th fucking hour, but he is panting, exhausted, he's still wounded from the tournament. He has been useless this entire book, and now he can't fight. Even Rebecca's like, yeah, if you go in there like this, you are absolutely going to die. But I guess we can at least die together. So Bois Guilbert watches all of this. He watches, you know, Rebecca and Ivanhoe have a bit of a spark, and he flushes. And there's this horrible mixture of emotions on his face.
Can we have a toilet flush sound there?
No.
Okay. I was like, he flushes what? I mean, you just shit off the for a hole back then, right? He's just sitting there on the toilet fuming at the sight of those two.
So now, I hate to say it, Daniel, but I think we're entering endgame.
Wow.
Listener, are you ready for the huge epic battle between two sworn enemies?
Yes.
Well, you're not gonna get it! They get on their horses, and they charge at each other. Ivanhoe's lance barely even taps Bois Guilbert, right? Ivanhoe basically misses. And yet Bois Guilbert flies off his horse. What's happening? Is he throwing the match so Rebecca can live? No! He's dead! He died of a heart attack or a stroke or something from having too many passionate feelings about Rebecca. I've never seen someone roll less than a natural one before. So Rebecca's free. Hooray!
Hooray.
Bit of a damp squib, though.
Yeah.
So now we get into kind of epilogue-y territory, right? King Richard formally returns to the throne, and we get the sense that Prince John and some of his Norman yes-men are going to get a bit of a spanking. Ivanhoe and Rowena get married. Congratulations to the beigest couple in all of literature. And the prefab I wrote here is, boy, are you Ethan Slater, because I am confused why girls are fighting over you. You don't know who Ethan Slater
yeah,
is.
What is that?
The day after the wedding, Rebecca visits Rowena. So Rebecca tells Rowena that she and Isaac, they're done with England. They're going to the south of Spain, where the Muslim king allows people of all religions to live in peace, and where there's a lot more gender equality. And this is actually true of the medieval period, like in sort of Muslim-dominated cultures like the south of Italy or the south of Spain. Women could be doctors, and yeah, there were much bigger, you know, diverse religious populations.
Rebecca goes off. She has a brilliant medical career or whatever abroad. Ivanhoe and Rowena, they have their kind of okay-ish marriage. The narrator says they were fond enough of each other, but Ivanhoe thought about Rebecca a lot. And it's kind of implied he regretted not choosing her. Oh well, Ivanhoe has a pretty good career for a couple of years. You know, he makes partner or whatever, I don't know. Then Richard the Lionheart dies suddenly, and then Ivanhoe didn't really do anything again. He just kind of existed. Prince John, he ascended to the throne. And he escalated some problems for the Jewish population that would lead to their eventual expulsion from England. Rebecca and Isaac had good foresight in getting out of there. As for England, well, the two languages, Norman, French and Saxon, they start to merge. Hooray! And the two groups of people, they merge and become English. Hooray again! So, that's the end. We got England. It's not what we wanted, but it's what we've deserved, wasn't it? Lackluster ending.
I can't believe I let a copy of this book touch me. So, that was the medieval romp that was Ivanhoe. Justine, what do you think? I'm sure you have a ton of opinions. I mean, what did Walter Scott get right? What did he get wrong? Thank you, Justine. I never would have thought about it like that. Okay, would you like some casting?
Yes, I would.
And this might be the greatest casting I've ever done.
Ooh.
I'm really, really...
That's saying something, because it's been pretty good.
Oh, thank you. So, once upon a time, this book was considered a fun romp, beloved by children and adults alike. The book already has a ton of songs in it, and the text, as we've heard, is very concerned about fabric. This is a Muppet movie.
Ah!
Obviously, Kermit would play Ivanhoe. We'd have dueling Miss Piggies, one in a blonde wig and one in a brunette wig.
Funny, because of the whole Jewish thing.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, wait, I suppose you don't eat yourself, do you? If you're...
No, but I'm sure they could make some sort of joke there. And for the one essential human cast member, right, because we always have to have one human in it, our Irish Norman, Bois Guilbert, that's got to be played by Andrew Scott, otherwise known as Hot Priest, playing this completely straight and as psychotically villainous as possible.
Yeah, because he can do that, yeah.
He'd be perfect because he has insane chemistry with everyone he comes in contact with, and he would genuinely sell to me that he wants to f*** that pig. And now for our segment, Bad Goodreads Reviews. It gave off sexist vibes. Ivanhoe was semi-sexy from what I could gather of him. Cedric was low-key yummy, I guess. 1 star. What?
Sorry, that tickled me.
I spent most of my life thinking Ivanhoe was a book about sled dogs or something. 1 star. All right. Thank you, guys. You made Daniel laugh really hard today, and that's all we can really ask for.
I just really needed some good cheer after reading that.
It's turned you loopy.
Yeah.
Let's get to some analysis. As per usual, let's start with the form of the book, right? Because there are sort of three major set pieces in this. There's the tournament, there's the big castle siege, and then there's the trial. And it's like broken up into extremely bitty parts under these big umbrellas. It's always interrupting itself. It's always destroying the tension. It has really weird time scales and like a million subplots that you and I didn't even bother covering.
It's a bit Tristram Shandy at times, but not intentionally. You get these bits where it's like, but before I can get to that, let me just, you know, you're just like, just for God's sake. Maybe it's a sort of commentary on the slow-moving feudal world.
You know what? Maybe. Or maybe he just had a different style of writing that...
is shite.
I'm trying to be generous here clearly there was something about it where so many people found this wonderful. But, like, you and I, even in this quite large retelling, we've streamlined a lot of it.
This is the wrong way of putting it, but it was more about, like, depth than breadth. Or maybe it was more about breadth than depth.
Well, that's my next point.
Because it's the descriptiveness, isn't it, I think, that he's really into and, like, trying to... in this sort of, like, just listing way that he does it, he just wants to kind of flesh out a historical world, and in that sense, he's not interested in narrative progression.
I wonder if that's why people took to it so much, because they'd never seen anything like it, where it's just lists of stuff and world-building, but none of it feels very selective.
Mm.
Yeah, I wonder if people were just a little amazed because they had never experienced a novel like this before.
But the other thing I was thinking that was funny was that... this brings us back all the way to episode 4 in Gawain and the Green Knight, which also just endlessly describes clothes, but in a very different way. But I wonder if maybe Walter Scott was trying to draw from that medieval tradition. That's what's cool about it, if I could be so generous to say so.
It's too generous.
Yeah, it's like an 18th century novel, late 18th century novel. It's like one of those Gothic books we've read, but just crammed with that kind of period detail that changes it into something new. And you can see that he is inventing something in that respect.
Yeah.
He just doesn't do it very well.
I can appreciate that this is something new and therefore exciting and novel, but man, having seen people come after him and do it a lot better.
Yeah.
But building off of that, like, how much is he borrowing from actual medieval texts? There was... such a huge cast of characters here, and I wondered if he was trying to do a sort of Chaucer panoramic thing across all groups and classes, but it doesn't work. This still feels so claustrophobic somehow.
Yeah, and sterile,
You use the word sterile, and I think that's a really good word to use with this, because even though we go into all of these different groups, they all kind of feel the same.
Mm.
You have maybe a little bit of light comic relief with the Merry Men or with Girth and Wamba, but that's about it. Like, every scene feels the same. Every character talks the same. He's telling, not showing.
Yeah.
There's no difference between any of the Saxons or the Normans or the Merry Men, really. I mean, they're all just it all feels exactly the same, and that's why I was just like, please get me out of this world.
That was the thing that I was thinking about, that the historical novel as a genre, and I was thinking about The Castle of Otranto, which obviously is not a historical novel, but it is a pretend historical document, and it does that in a much funnier way, or a much more entertaining way, where it uses a lot of deliberately old-fashioned vocabulary in a slightly obfuscating way, doesn't it, where it goes like, forsooth, the cask did fall apart, and you're like, what's going on with this thing? Whereas this, it does a bit kind of, and he actually explicitly says it at times, it's that sort of like, I'm a 19th century person translating.
Yeah.
It's almost like a time traveler looking at stuff and telling us what it's like. And he explicitly says that about the language. Don't worry, this character spoke Saxon, this character spoke French, but I'll just do it in this kind of cod medieval way for all of them.
Yeah.
And in that respect, it sort of kills it, doesn't it? You lose the immediacy of the world he's describing.
You know what it is? This is like somebody describing a TikTok video to somebody else, rather than showing it. And I'm going to describe five of them, and they're all very different, but because it's filtered through me, it's mediated, it's not funny, it all kind of sounds the same. That's what it feels like. It feels like a second-hand narrator. Yeah. You've referenced The Castle of Otranto a number of times through this, right? And I was thinking that this is coming right in the sort of High Gothic period, at the tail end of the High Gothic period, and it's using a ton of elements from the Gothic playbook, ideas of revenge and outsiders and virtuous young maidens carried off by brutes and castles and, you know, this fake medieval landscape, right? But it's using all of these elements in a totally different way. So this is Gothic if you subtract all of the terror, all of the psychological engagement, and all of the supernatural elements.
I think I read this, it was only on Wikipedia or something, so it might not be true, but I read that Walter Scott collaborated with Matthew Lewis.
Ugh.
So there is a kind of connection there. And I think you can see that the historical novel does draw from the Gothic, but to very different ends.
Yeah, yeah.
The Jewish stuff is interesting, isn't it? Because he's obsessed with it.
Well, let's talk about that then.
Yeah.
Miscegenation and race. That's the whole, like, big theme of this book. Is Scott racist? Because a lot of the bad Goodreads, it annoyed the shit out of me because they kept saying, this is such an anti-Semitic book because some of the characters in the book said anti-Semitic things. And I was like, okay.
Get a grip.
Well, I'm like, yeah, a lot of the villains are sounding like they're doing bits from an offensive 80s stand-up routine. But what a character says does not automatically mean that that's what the book is getting behind, right?
I know. Yeah.
It felt like a real lack of literacy on the part of the commentators.
Yeah.
I was like, well, yeah, if the big bad villain is saying this, do you think Scott is supporting this message?
Yeah.
Or working against it?
You could say it was anti-Semitic in another way, in as much as it's excessively obsessed with the place of Jews within English culture and also orientalizes them.
Yeah, so that's a different thing. If you wanted to talk about how it orientalizes Rebecca, that's a really valid critique, but people were saying because some characters are racist,
that I get that. I'm just saying, like, you could make an argument they're not doing that,
but that's not what they're saying.
That was, I did think it just about racism in the book in general, because it's kind of the world that, again, back to Gone with the Wind, the world that it portrays is like a sort of weird Jim Crow Middle Ages, where Saxons and Normans have to drink from different water fountains or what have you. And I was, because you do get those people that say that the origin of race, one of the kind of origins of racial discourse is from the ideas of aristocracy versus common birth and that idea of like being of different blood. But this felt like way too projecting that onto the Middle Ages. I don't think, was it that sort of, I mean, again, I need Justine or someone, but I don't think it was quite like this, was it? I don't think it was quite as explicitly Jim Crow-like.
Justine, do you want to help us out here? If this came out today, I felt like Scott was sort of quote-unquote woke in this way. Like, he says explicitly, no one is pure, no one's really from here. And I thought that was kind of weird and a little bit backtracky, given his earlier literary focus on the culture of Scotland and the beauty of its unsullied culture, supposedly.
Well, maybe it's an attack on England.
Yeah, maybe. It might just be, Okay, so we were talking about Rebecca being more interesting than Rowena. Let's talk about gender in this, because this is a pretty sexist book. I don't think there's any way about it. You've given me kind of one strong female protagonist, but there are like three women in this book. Two hotties and a hag.
Good ratio.
That's what we want to see, boys.
I mean, one of them is complex and competent, and the complexity is where her sexuality is most strongly rooted, the fact that she's the most interesting.
Don't like that. See, that's already shifting the ratio, isn't it?
Yeah.
Complex, hottie, hag.
You want...
We want the bimbos, please.
You want a basic biddy.
Yes.
I mean, people actually were kind of furious that he got with Rowena at the end. There was a proper call for, you know, can you rewrite this? And I think people did do, like, stage versions and stuff later on where they rewrote it where he got with Rebecca. Because people were like, this is a dumb ending. We forgot Rowena existed.
Well, we also forgot that Ivanhoe existed.
That's fair. What a weird hero this is. Like, man, he's really undercutting a sort of masculine ideal. He is barely in the book. He is so bland that we know nothing about him. He needs help at the tournament because he's getting his ass kicked. He spends most of the book unconscious or a helpless invalid. And even the big rescue at the end, he's too weak and exhausted to succeed. The book is very clear about that. And Bois Guilbert would have had a stroke regardless.
Yeah, it pegs male violent impulses to male libido.
Yeah.
And it portrays that as ultimately self-destructive. So I kind of wondered again, is there a sort of like progressivist thing here that like soon we won't be like this? And, you know, one day this kind of man would, this kind of barbarian man wouldn't be able to survive or whatever. I kind of thought again it's, and because especially because Ivanhoe's sort of a kind of middling guy.
Yeah.
Is it a kind of like, don't worry, the mild-mannered middle classes are on their way?
Yeah, because I mean, even his ending, Walter Scott could have said he and Rowena had this wonderful marriage and okay, Richard died, but Ivanhoe went on to this, and he's like, actually, marriage was fine. He kind of didn't do anything after Richard died. He just sadly existed, and his life was kind of a damp squib, so, and just like, what are we meant to take away from him? That, you know what? Men are harmful or useless at best. Maybe this is a feminist text for the ages.
Yeah, there we go. That's it. We've done it. Cracked it.
Right, so here's some advice.
And I need this.
Yeah, you needed it for this book. I'm sorry it's coming too late.
Yeah, you're like Ivanhoe, aren't you? Turning up. Late and useless.
Sometimes you're going to have to read a big, dumb, boring book, and you don't have much time to do it. So I'm going to give you guys some advice on speed reading for days when you just have to fucking get through it. Now, this advice obviously might not be useful to any listeners with reading disabilities like dyslexia, but it may be helpful to somebody, right? So I'm going to talk to you about how I speed read. So speed reading is essentially very focused skimming, but not like skimming when you're bored. It does require a lot of focus. You can't let your mind drift.
Right, I thought it was going to be way easier. Okay, keep going.
So read the first sentence of every new paragraph fully, because that often sets up big moments of context or big transitions. And then after that, bounce your eyes to every other word so your brain kind of fills in the blanks and you're not lingering, but you're also not really missing anything that's important. You can also use your finger to trace along, and that helps with focus, and it helps with speed, because you can actually use your finger to speed up. That's called the hand pacing method. And your eyes will follow it. You will trick yourself into reading faster.
I want one of those like Mickey Mouse bouncing balls.
Don't we all, yeah. Daniel? And if your eyes get tired of repetitive motion, you can also scan down the middle of paragraphs. So go vertically instead of horizontally, and you'll actually pick up a lot of the main ideas and keywords from going sort of down the middle.
I think you're going to say, keep your eyes still and move the book from side to side.
So let's have a clue then to our next episode. In our last two books, we had a dark-haired siren named Rebecca, who always loses the wealthy guy to a pale-haired dork. What if our next book also had a pale dork get the guy? Kinda. Her name isn't Rowena, but it's not a million miles off.
Oh yeah, very good.
Right, so please follow us on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. Please write into savemefrommyshelf@gmail.com. We love getting letters from you guys, any suggestions, things like that. And from Daniel and myself, we're f***ing tired.
Yeah, that means, well, yeah. I am.
Nothing more to say. We love you all. We need to go have a nap now.
Thanks for listening to Save Me From My Shelf. Our music is The Overture to Don Giovanni by Mozart, and cover art is by Catherine Wu.
Our thanks to Aston University's Center for Critical Inquiry and to Society and Culture for funding the startup of this podcast. Contact us at savemefrommyshelf@gmail.com or at smfms_podcast on Twitter. And do not, I'm going to remind you, do not forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Do not forget. Thank you.